The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
It looks like we have about half seated and half in line, so that might be a good time to start the Bible study. I've been distributing a few maps here and there. Some of you have maps in your Bible. We're just going to be using these maps if you could share with someone. I have a couple more here. This way you get to meet your neighbor. Would you guys like a map to look at?
Sure.
Would you like a map? Sure. You need a third hand for maps. Okay. Good, good, good. All right. We'll distribute maps. Everybody, you've got maps. Okay, good. What you're looking at then is Galilee, right smack in the middle, and the Sea of Galilee. And what we're going to try and do is sort of, would you like one, Jen? Oh, you've got some. So you passed your map. Good, excellent. If you need a Bible, they are on the worship book racks. You're welcome to have a Bible. My name is Julia, for those of you who arrived yesterday. We have been looking at the idea of border crossing and migration across borders and sort of expanding that metaphorically to say, okay, what happens when you step across a threshold? What is that threshold? Is it entering an enemy's house? Is it meeting a new neighbor who was a stranger, but now you know them and you get to be friends? Is it trying to use another language or crossing cultural barriers? So we're going to play with that a little bit and look at the way Jesus is crossing boundaries. Yesterday we looked at Mark 5 with the Gerasene demoniac, and we discovered that boundaries are not only social things that we cross, but also the Gerasene demoniac was bound by chains and yet broke them, and so was free but bound up inside by the demon or demons that possessed him. So there's a kind of breaking bounds can also be breaking personal boundaries or breaking chains. And what I'll do for a little while is kind of review our walk from, or not really our walk because we haven't walked it yet together, but Jesus' walk from chapter 5 to chapter 7. So that's why you have the maps. And before we get into this, our goal is the Syrophoenician woman in chapter 7, verses 24 through 30. So it's a very short chapter, short pericope, short section, paragraph. And there are many ways to read it. Okay? So I didn't get the red hair for no reason at all. We're going to push into the fiery, uncomfortable regions for reading this passage. Okay? So just know that there are multiple ways of reading. We'll look at some of the multiple ways, but I would like us to go the most difficult route in reading this story. So, if you'll grab your map or grab a neighbor who has a map. Let me take you through briefly. In chapter 5, Jesus is entering into the country of the Gerasenes, or on your map it's called the Gadarenes. I think in Matthew he's called the Gadarene demoniac, or the two Gadarene demoniacs. Matthew always doubles things. Everybody find Gadara in the Decapolis, bottom, right-hand quadrant of the map.
East of the sea.
Notice that it is, as we talked about yesterday, outside of the bounds of Galilee. It is in Gentile territory. And then from Gadara, or Gerasene, as it's also known, Jesus crosses the Galilee again and meets a synagogue leader. So from deep Gentile territory with the pigs to deep Jewish territory with the synagogue leaders. Okay, back and forth. And there he's talking to a synagogue leader who has a daughter who is ill. And then the story with the woman with the flow of blood, she reaches out and touches Jesus' cloak. She's healed. And then when they continue their journey, they discover that they're too late for the synagogue's leader's daughter. She's passed. Jesus says, forget about what they say. Listen to what I say, right? So he goes to the synagogue leader's home, right? So we're going to see Jesus moving from homes. So with the Gerasene demoniac, he's in the tombs. He's in out in the wilderness tombs outside the city. With the synagogue leader, he's in the home. Okay? Switching boundaries again, or switching spaces. Then in chapter 6, Jesus goes to his hometown. What would that be? Nazareth. Good. And you can find Nazareth right next to the L and the A in Galilee. So notice how far he's gone. He went from Gadara or Gadara across the Sea of Galilee to a synagogue leader's home. Then he goes to Nazareth. He's at home. And in Nazareth, he has a big discussion with his people. He can't do much. He doesn't have much power. A prophet is not well received in his hometown. Then he calls the 12 to them and he sends them out. So sends them on mission. I'm not having any success at home. Why don't you guys go out and try and have some success? That's my commentary. He doesn't actually say that. And then in the middle of the story, Jesus sends out the 12. We get sort of a parenthesis where we hear about John the Baptist beheaded by Herod, and we get the whole story of Herod's stepdaughter dancing, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And this story is bracketed by Jesus sending out the 12 and the 12 coming back in. So it sort of is the time is passing story. Okay. The 12 come back. They've had great success. And Jesus says, now you need to rest. Let me take you to a deserted place. That deserted place is on the Sea of Galilee. So we go from Nazareth back to the Sea of Galilee. This is really his pivot point, the sea right here. And since we're talking about water and anchoring ourselves in the rain slash rain of God and water imagery and baptism, it's interesting that just to note that Jesus is circling around the Sea of Galilee. In that deserted place on the Sea of Galilee, he feeds 5,000 people. And then he says to his disciples, you go on. I'm going to stay here. He dismisses the crowds. He goes up on a mountain and he prays. The disciples rode to Bethsaida. And you can find that on the north point of the Sea of Galilee. Disciples rode to Bethsaida. Jesus catches up by walking on water. And finally, they meet in Bethsaida. Next, I've added a name in there. There is a mass healing at Gennesaret. Okay, so that's between Capernaum, sort of to the left and south of Bethsaida, between Capernaum and Magdala. Okay. Now, we get to chapter 7. And in chapter 7, I have to get to chapter 7. Here we go. From healing the sick in Gennesaret, where everybody is just coming to him and touching his cloak and being healed and seeing him in the marketplaces, and they're bringing the sick and just laying them down, hoping that Jesus will walk by them. It's sort of like that scene in The Matrix. Has anybody seen that where, I forget which episode, might be the last one, where Neo walks out of the big elevator and all these people just waiting for him, just lying, mats on the floor, just waiting. Okay, not too many Matrix fans. That's all right. That's all right. It doesn't work for my college students either. I'm sort of an in-betweener here. The next thing that happens is he's back speaking with Jews. Not the synagogue leader, but he's speaking with Pharisees. And this is sort of a long portion. If you look in chapter 7, it goes from verses 1 to 23. Okay? It's a bit long. And it's titled, at least in my HarperCollins NRSV, it is titled The Tradition of the Elders. And here, Jesus is going to have a discussion with the Pharisees in sort of a repartee, as I described it in the paragraph about this session, a jousting of words. who knows the tradition better? Whose position in Judaism is a more strong position? Christians do this all the time, except we sort of do it for blood. You know, we sort of try and push people into the water. When you, not Lutherans to Lutherans, I won't go there. But if you think about the more extremes of Christianity, when they come together, if they do, usually we're just arguing with strong men. We don't even talk to each other in Christianity. No. Oh, I'm evangelical, but they're, you know, fundamentalist or liberal or this or that. And we use all these different ways of talking, labeling people. So Jesus is having this conversation, this jousting. And if you'll notice in 7:3, if we're trying to figure out who Mark's audience is, in 7:3, Mark says, and your editors have put it in parentheses, "For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they thoroughly wash their hands, thus observing the tradition of the elders. And they do not eat anything from the marketplace unless they wash it. And there are also many other traditions that they observe, the washing of cups, pots, and bronze kettles." End parenthesis. Again, the parentheses are from your editors, your nice English translators here. But can you see that this is an explanation that the author has put in to explain Judaism to people who might not know Pharisaic tradition? All right, so here we have a boundary crossing too, right? The author, Mark, is helping his readers or original hearers cross the boundary into Jewish tradition and understand how Pharisees operated. And this is important for him. He wants, even though it's not an experience that the people he's writing for originally have had, they don't maybe know Pharisees, or they haven't had contact with Jews who won't eat with them or something like that. This Gentile audience for Mark is being taken across into another cultural boundary for a purpose, and 22 verses of purpose. So before we come to the Syrophoenician, we want to know what that purpose is. What's happening here with this story, and why is it right before the Syrophoenician woman? The Pharisees and the scribes in verse 5 ask Jesus, "Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders? Why do they eat with defiled hands?" This is a little bit, for those of you who were here yesterday, a little bit reminiscent of the Gerasene demoniac. We're talking about purity. There, it was purity of people, community, place, the tombs, the dead. That's a different kind of impurity. The demons, that's a different kind of impurity. Here, it's about eating and washing. So we've shifted impurities. And the Pharisees say, "You abandon the commandment of God and you uphold human tradition." Then Jesus said to them in verse 9, "You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to keep your tradition." I had to read these two verses a couple times. They're saying the exact same thing to each other. You don't keep the commandments of God. What you do is human tradition. You don't keep the commandments of God. What you do is human tradition. This is us again, the Christians. Oftentimes, I mean, deep theologies are fought over, and people die over deep theologies. But often, we wish we could find a way, or I wish we could find a way through them. So Jesus continues, "Moses said, 'Honor your father and mother, whoever speaks evil,' but you say, blah, blah, blah." And essentially, the Pharisees have just accused Jesus of his disciples not eating in the correct way. And now Jesus accuses the Pharisees of not taking care of their parents. You all, in order to get away with not taking care of your parents, which is your responsibility according to Torah, according to the law, and according to our traditions, and to get away with not taking care of them, you take a priestly vow, a Pharisaic vow, and you say, "Oh no, so sorry, parents. All my money is for God. You can't have any." But in God's commandments, it says, take care of your parents, honor your father and mother. So Jesus is going a little bit deeper, right? From washing hands to, are you caring for your family? Are you taking on your responsibility in taking care of your parents? So back and forth, back and forth. This is the verbal jousting. Then Jesus goes a step further and he calls the crowd and he says, listen, everybody, not just the Pharisees. He opens it up to public conversation. There's nothing outside of a person that going in can defile, but the things that come out are what defile. Now that makes sense. Right? So you can't put bad language into yourself, right, and be a bad person. Psychologically, we're not talking psychologically. There's a lot of damage that happens that way. But it's really the bad language that comes out of our mouth that reveals that we are a bad person. Maybe. So this is what he's talking about. Then he explains it to his disciples. So he goes from the Pharisees to the crowds, now to his disciples. And he says to his disciples, did you also fail to understand? He's so rough on the disciples in this book, in this gospel. Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from the outside cannot defile? So stepping across the boundary of the lakeshore into the tombs to talk with a Gentile possessed by demons, surrounded by dead people, that can't defile you. It's not what happens on the outside that defiles you. Jesus continues, since it enters not the heart, but the stomach, and then goes into the sewer. Jesus is very polite. And in parentheses, your editors have put it in parentheses, thus Jesus declared all foods clean. And the subtext is, hint, hint, Gentile community who follows Jesus, you're not eating the wrong way. Don't listen to this other Pharisaic teaching. You're doing just fine. Jesus already declared your foods clean, so you're okay. Right? So there's this teaching within the text that strengthens the community practices of the audience, right? The believers that are receiving this gospel in the first century. Verse 21, for it is from within, from the human heart, that evil intentions come. And then he lists them. And this is what's typically called, the bad things list. I can't think of the right name for it. But a list of all the things you shouldn't do, like the list of don'ts. The vice list. Thank you. Thank you. This is what scholars call the vice list. And it's not that Jesus was speaking to fornicators and telling them to change their ways. He was just saying to the people, like these things that you know you're not supposed to do, right? These are the things that come out of the heart, and these are the things that corrupt you from the inside. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person. All right, so far so good. Verse 24, from there, Jesus set out, and he went away to the region of Tyre. So now you have to check your maps again. Where were we? We were just in Gennesaret and talking to Pharisees. Northwest side of the Sea of Galilee. Can you find Tyre?
But how far is that? Yeah. It's hard to,
Far. Well, no, I don't know. I know ancient maps. I don't know, really. Contemporary maps. But it's farther than he has been in the previous seven chapters. It's off the map.
May have been almost as far as
he went. As what?
As far as he went.
Almost. Almost. We'll get to the end of the thing and he goes even farther, but which is curious to me. So Tyre is up at the top point. Right? From there He set out and went away to the region of Tyre. So maybe he didn't go in the city, but he's in that region. What do you notice about that region? Oh, he went back to the seashore. Good. Jesus is a homing. He's like those water sticks. What else do you notice about Tyre? It's outside of Galilee. We are no longer in Jewish territory. So this is kind of a parallel story to the southeast Gerasene demoniac story, but in the opposite direction. You see? So he went outside the lines, the bounds of the Gentiles in the southeast to Gadara or Gerasene. And then he goes outside the boundaries to the northwest. Mm-hmm. What land is this? Syrophoenicia, Syria. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good. And just to jump ahead, because we may not get back here. In verse 31, so something we're going to get a story of the Syrophoenician woman in Tyre. And then if you look in verse 31, the next story, then Jesus returned from the region of Tyre. Now explain this to me. He went by way of Sidon towards the Sea of Galilee. Now, Jesus has a crazy sense of direction. But maybe what it is he went toward the region of Tyre, and much like the California coast, if you go towards the sea, you're going down. And then to come back up, maybe he was going in the direction of Sidon, and then he comes back around to the Sea of Galilee. But this is a long trajectory. And he's not just on the border. He went into the heartland of Syria. Last week we were talking about the prophets, Elijah and Elisha, and one of them goes and, oh, sorry, and Jezebel and Ahab, and Jezebel was a Sidonian princess, right? So way out of the boundaries of Israel bringing in, okay? So Jesus is traveling a lot. Now we get this short passage, right? We have this long passage of verbal jousting with the Pharisees. Do you think Jesus won? For this audience, he won. And thus Jesus declared all foods clean. Now we get this shorter passage in 24 through 30. And let me just read the whole thing. And what I'd like you to, I'd like just your gut reactions. I know you are all experts on this text, but listen to it again and see what you hear. From there, Jesus set out and went away to the region of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know he was there. Yet he could not escape notice. And a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately heard about him, and she came and bowed down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile of Syrophoenician origin. She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. He said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he said to her, "For saying that, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." So she went home, and she found the child lying on the bed and the demon gone. Give me a gut reaction.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. All right. Jesus was angry. What? A persistent woman. Other reactions.
I don't like this Jesus who denies her initially.
You don't like this Jesus. Jesus denying. He's rude. What?
Maybe he was testing her.
How does she know instantly the demon's gone when she gets home? Probably because her daughter is still and not, right? So if you think epilepsy might be an interpretation of a demonic possession, something like that. Back row?
There's a theme of secrecy.
Secrecy, there's a secrecy theme, yeah, all the way through Mark, good.
Even a little of what you have is more than enough for me.
Yeah, even a crumb of healing. Can, yeah, good.
She acknowledged her subservience to the Jewish faith of being the dogs and the people.
Yeah, dogs doesn't necessarily mean subservient to Jewish faith.
I heard it was the puppy dogs, the family puppy.
No family puppy dogs.
No.
She's an outsider.
Jesus seems like elite and snob.
Jesus seems elite and snobby.
Well, she acknowledged herself as an outsider.
But she's in her homeland.
But to his question,
she believes the foreign prophet.
But to his question,
she does not.
She does not
fight him.
Yeah, she doesn't dispute.
She doesn't object or dispute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
She allows that derogatory term. She accepts it. Or she doesn't fight it, but she lets it go.
And yet finds a way to receive what she needs within that.
Uh-huh. She works within it. Yeah.
But
she works
within
it.
But I don't think of a Jewish woman retorting the way she did. But she's Greek, so she...
Oh, she's Syrian. She's Syrian.
Okay. Well, it says a Greek woman.
Oh, okay.
And other. So, but in other words, she's not being the typical Jewish woman. Just shut up, and you're just a woman.
Why do you assume that Jewish women would just take it? Would be silent?
Because in the Jewish culture, the men had all the stuff. The women.
Our current view of Jewish women, TV.
Yeah. So I just want to say a little bit more about this. We have a lot of cultural assumptions, not just about our own time, but about ancient time. We've been taught a lot of things about ancient time. Judaism is this way in the ancient world. Gentiles are this way in the ancient world. Most of us have a biblical view. And the biblical view is from a very minority, particular way of understanding the ancient world. Doesn't mean it's wrong. It would be like a German Lutheran way of seeing the world. Okay? So it's culturally and ethnically oriented in this community. And there are many examples, even in the New Testament writings, of women who kind of stand up and go, "Nah, I don't think so, Jesus." Mary Martha, Jesus' mother. I don't care what you say. Who cares? It's not your hour. What are you talking about, Jesus? Go turn the water into wine. I mean, so we have to watch our cultural constructions. Even if we've heard it from experts, there will be other experts who offer something that's a little bit different. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know if the language, the translation helps us, but this, it feels brisk at first. But I can also see Jesus as very kind of saying, "Listen, we're feeding the kids. Let's get lunch done. Then we'll take care of your problem." And I'm not sure necessarily.
But he didn't say that.
Well, I know, but it doesn't say that either. It just says, "Let's feed the kids first." So that comes out of nowhere in the English. But I'm not sure.
Let's, yeah.
Anyway.
So, go ahead.
I think that woman has some kind of wisdom and is able to see through the parable immediately.
She's able to see through the parable immediately. And these folks are, "Bye, everybody. Blessings on your journey. They've got to catch a bus. There you go. Take a cookie for the road." Yes, ma'am.
And there's an element of respect. She bows down at his feet. She knows he has power. Mm-hmm. She respects him, I think, from beginning to end, regardless of
history. So let me try this move for you. And this is something you can do in your Bible studies when you don't have a first century cultural expert or two available to you. What you can do is say, all right, how does Mark, in the rest of Mark's story, not John, don't go that far, how does Mark, in the rest of Mark's story, help me to understand what's going on here? So two ways we can do that right here. There are other ways. But the first way is, I spent a lot of time on chapter 7 with the Pharisees, Jesus' repartee with the Pharisees. Right? Big, long discussion. They're using the same words back and forth. What is similar and different between that story immediately prior and the Syrophoenician woman? Let's just brainstorm similarities and differences.
Pharisees don't want to believe he's a prophet. She does.
Okay, so she's, again, we're back to the respect. She's recognizing something that the Pharisees are not. Good.
I said banter.
There's banter. Okay. Who wins?
She does.
She does. She changes Jesus' mind. There are the two interpretations that are most popular. I'm sorry to keep pointing. These are the two interpretations that are most popular. One interpretation of the story is she changes Jesus' mind. Another interpretation this gentleman offered a little bit earlier is he's testing her. Okay. Now watch what happens. If Jesus is testing her, are we troubled? Jesus is just testing her. She passes the test. Her daughter's healed. Troubling?
Yeah, he maybe already healed her, for all we know, from that test.
The troubling part there is I don't like Jesus testing people. I don't like the testing of faith. Consistent with some readings of the Bible. But that's the difficulty there. What's the difficulty if we, remember I said there are multiple ways to interpret, and we can explore all of them? I'm going to focus on the harder one, so I'm pushing to figure out which one's harder. What happens if Jesus has his mind changed by a Syrophoenician woman?
Yeah, it means that he does not fully comprehend his mission, that she's helping him to really understand.
She's helping him understand his mission. Is that hard?
Yes.
That's very hard.
God is supposed to know these things.
Son of God is supposed to know these things. Mark 1:1, this is the gospel of Jesus Christ, Son of God. So how do we understand the divine to be mind-changed? Well, the divine slash human, fully, both.
And how many of the other healing episodes does he test people before he heals them, or does he just heal them?
Just heals them. Right, good. So you're going to context. So this would be a strange way to read it in the context of Mark, where Jesus doesn't test anybody else to heal them. So for me, and you all see how you feel, the reading that Jesus is testing her keeps Jesus divine. I may not like the testing part, but it keeps Jesus who he is, and that's safer in some ways. This is a little more dangerous to say that a Syrophoenician woman changed Jesus' mind. He didn't understand his mission completely. So for this class, I'm going to go that way. Because it's scary. Because it's crossing a boundary. Because if we explore that route, doesn't mean you have to take it home. But if you explore it, if we explore it, we might learn something about our own boundaries. Our own God has to be this way. And according to Bart, as soon as we say God is this, we've missed it. As soon as we put a name on God, it's the wrong name. We can never, humanly, we can never encompass who God is. We can never completely understand who God is. And so if we say, oh, but Jesus, God would act this way. No. Because God is always bursting open. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Hello, bird. God is always bursting open our categories. So me, I like to go where my categories are broken. And I understand that that's hard, and it may be hard to lead congregations that way too. Poor little bird, there you go. Have some chocolate chip oatmeal things. Where are we? Okay. Now compare this story to the Gerasene demoniac. Remember, we focused a lot on language in the Gerasene demoniac. The Gerasene demoniac bows down. There's a demon involved. The demon recognizes Jesus. This woman recognizes something of Jesus, who he is, what he can do. What's different about Jesus's role? In the Syrophoenician story, Jesus plods through territory all the way up to Tyre and sits down in a house. Probably a Jewish home, staying with cousins or something, or someone who's invited him. So he's at home and she invades the home. In the Gerasene demoniac story, The demoniac, the possessed man, is in the tombs. Jesus steps out of the boat and enters his home. We have a reverse here of hospitality and host and guest. Do you see what I'm saying? You see the bird. Tweet, tweet, tweet. No, just kidding. Do you see the difference? Jesus is tired in the Tyre story. He's just been at Gennesaret where there were more people than he could even walk by to heal. So he's gone again, perhaps for rest, although it doesn't say that. And his boundaries are being crossed rather than him taking the initiative to cross boundaries, which is interesting. So what happens when we have our boundaries crossed? Nice to have someone cross them respectfully. Well, it's fine if you call me a dog, but really, according to your own religion, you should treat dogs this way. Dog is never a compliment, and it's not the diminutive here. It's not a compliment. Dog is a really derogatory term in the ancient world. And there was a group of philosophers called the Cynic philosophers. Cynic is a play on the word dog. They did a lot of things in public that we would not consider appropriate for public behavior because they were trying to remind people that we are just animals at the base of it. So we don't need special latrines. We don't need special boudoirs. We don't need special bedrooms. We should just do everything in public like the dogs. So these philosophers, not related to today's cynics so much, these philosophers were called dogs, kunis, right? The same word, dog, cynic, as a derogatory term that they turned around and said, yes, we are. We live like the wild animals. So even from that context, not a polite term. She bows down. She corrects. And Jesus, to his credit, if we go the extreme way, responds. What do we learn from this? What happens if we're Jesus, like I said, and we have our boundaries crossed? How do you hear that?
So this shows his humanity, that he's vulnerable and he's still open to learning. What else is out there for mm-hmm. that someone else has a voice and he's mm-hmm. open to hearing that? For me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's not acting like the Pharisees would act, but showing like kind of humble response.
Nice. So if we compare Jesus to the Pharisees sort of dig in. Jesus could dig in and say, get out of the house. But he doesn't. He says, you know what? That is sound reasoning. And this is part of my mission. And responds that way. In hospitality, what he should have offered in the first place since he's at the home and she's coming in. Right? Did you have a... No, we'll come back. Yeah.
I just had a strange thought that perhaps Jesus said that he's in a Jewish home. And
I'm assuming he is. It doesn't say.
In a house, but uh-huh. he went to Tyre. We know it was a synagogue in Tyre. Probably was.
I don't know.
He was stating something that was pretty common among the Pharisees. Pharisees say he came across like a Pharisee and he was parroting what the Pharisees said. She caught on to it and he said that even the dogs need the feeding from God.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that Jesus, ironically, because we just had this long story about arguing with the Pharisees where Jesus came out on top. So ironically, he's stating a position of the Pharisees over here.
By that statement.
By that one statement. And then he shifts. Yeah, isn't that interesting? Go ahead.
I'm really seeing Jesus' humanity. With the paradigm, if he's been in this extreme ministry place, and maybe he's going to tire and rest. And he's like, what's outside of the Jewish? They don't know about me. I'm going to rest.
So maybe outside of Jewish territory, he can rest. I'm just repeating what you're saying for folks. And because now the Jews won't know where he is.
Yeah, so it's like his highway spot, and yet someone still comes to him. So he's annoyed, and he's like, I'm kind of at my I don't want to do any more healing.
I came here to refuel. I have to admit, I felt that way at Holden. I came here to refuel. Well, I didn't. I came here to teach, but I'm an introvert, and so I kind of have to do the, I'm going to get my coffee, and I'm going to go over here, sit under the tree, and drink my coffee, right? So I can really identify with that side of Jesus. He was a lot more generous with his time than I'm able to be. Yes, ma'am, and then we'll go.
I kind of see it that both Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman both humble themselves in a way.
So both Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman humble themselves how?
Because the Syrophoenician woman is there begging, and she's on a mission.
She's begging.
She's begging for the healing, and she's persistent.
She's persistent.
Trying to do it, and she even compares herself to a dog, like what we were talking about.
Yeah.
In doing that, she kind of flips the model and teaches Jesus, the rabbi, a different way of looking at it, and he has to accept that she's right.
So when she accepts a humble position, she's able to teach someone who has taken a higher position. And because he's receptive, he humbles himself to meet her. Very nice.
Perhaps just remind him. Maybe he doesn't.
Or remind him, yeah. Very nice. Did you have a?
I've always said, kind of found it curious what he actually says to her.
Okay.
Which is, for saying that, you may go.
For saying that, you may go. So this is an interesting response. How does that strike you?
There's no statement of faith, or your faith has, you know, there's no comment about faith. There are other places too where faith either comes afterwards.
Or right. So often when Jesus...
Is there any other place where he says that, you know, just for saying that, go ahead.
Mm-mm.
That's very curious to me. I don't know what to make of it.
So usually when Jesus heals, he is responding to people and saying, your faith has healed you, or which is easier to say, take up your mat and walk, or your sins are forgiven. Right? So
I see a cultural piece where she's saying, you know, as a dog, I'm not Jewish, I don't follow your ways, you don't know who I am, but I believe you will even help me. And that's where that language takes me, as I read that, that even as a lesser being in her own eyes, that she still believes he can take care of her.
Even though I'm an outsider, I trust that you will heal me. I still need to be fed by God. Yeah. But it is, you're right, it's a unique response. And the anger isn't gone. Like, to me, he doesn't get warm and fluffy or warm and fuzzy. For saying that, you know, she's healed. Go. it's a response. It's not, come share my meal, take a little soup to her. It's not over the top. And yet he often does when he's in other people's homes. When he eats with tax collectors, and then he sort of turns the tables and says, tax collector, why are you condemning this woman who's weeping on my feet? You didn't show me proper hospitality. I will show her hospitality. She's being the host in your home. And so often Jesus flips that. But you're right. So we have to look at all of those aspects. There was someone over here. Yeah.
Well, if he's been moving through all these different cultures, I'm thinking that part of understanding other cultures is that you have to listen to them. And so it wasn't surprising to me to take it in a way that he was actually listening to her.
Yeah.
And I knew that his forsaking that could be taken as a rebuke, but I also didn't take it that way. I took it more as almost, this is a reward. Okay, you shared that with me, even though you're, you know, bowing to me and worshiping. You're sharing with me about your culture, yourself, and now you can go.
Yeah, so it's a recognition of her border crossing and an honoring of that, much like the humility. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just wanted to highlight, and then we'll come over here for a last comment. She uses the same language is used for her as for the Gerasene demoniac. She bows at his feet and she begs, which is exactly what the Gerasene demoniac did. So we have that similar language. So you are set up to think, we are set up to think, well, when someone begs, Jesus is going to say, okay. But he doesn't.
At first.
Yeah, so that's interesting. We had another hand. Yeah.
I'm just kind of imagining Mark's community would be a very interesting time when we have men and women, Jews and Gentiles out in this conversation and putting what happened before and this story together. He's trying to tell them maybe, look at the way that we should be talking with one another, not that we're set in our positions, but actually be in a conversation and things might change or open up for us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of it as Mark's sermon to his congregation.
Yeah. So certainly Jesus here, I'm going to look at the time and see if we have any time left. Oh, we do. So, let me say a couple things and then we'll get another comment. So just to repeat what you're saying, thinking about Mark's, oh, now we have a squirrel. Thinking about Mark's community, we might want to run that critter out before he eats the chocolate chip oatmeal slide thing. While he still remembers where the door is. So what you're saying is that what an interesting placement. We were talking about how Mark is explaining things for a community that is not so familiar with Jewish tradition. So how would they hear the Syrophoenician story? That their persistence in approaching the Son of God will be rewarded. That the mission may have been to the Jews, but it was broken open by a conversation. Wow. Now, think about that for your churches. If you go back to your churches and you think with people, or with your faith community, and think with people about, wow, we think our mission is this direction. How is that going to be broken open? What conversation might we have with the people to whom our mission is that would break open our mission and make us realize it needs to expand, it needs to go this way, it needs to go this way, we need to let this go and move this direction. So a lot of stuff going on there. You had a comment and then we'll go in the back.
I just wonder if this is in the synoptics at all, in Matthew or Luke.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how that differs, this story differs in those, if at all.
That's your assignment. Go look at it.
Is there anything in particular?
It's rougher here. Let me see. 24. Matthew 15. It's in Matthew 15. So give it a read through. Yes, ma'am.
I think he demonstrated cultural sensitivities because he used problems.
Jesus demonstrated cultural sensitivity.
And or they were teaching it to him as well.
Because he received her teaching to him. Very nice. Yeah. And I think it works. If you're willing to step across the comfort zone and say, okay, what if Jesus is embodying his full humanity here and is being corrected? That could be a model for me. That could be a model for my community to sit with this other community or this other neighbor or this other, and be corrected. And am I willing to take that humble position, to take that respectful position, to take that, am I willing to be called a dog in order to enter a conversation? And to keep entering conversation. So whether we take the Syrophoenician woman as an example, or Jesus as our example of how to respond, either way, we're asked to take on a position of discomfort in conversation with someone who is not like us. And that could be in another country, like Jesus did, or it could be in the neighborhood next door, or it could be, you know, with another pastor who makes me uncomfortable. And am I willing to enter into that conversation? Now, sometimes not. Sometimes it's more hurtful than not. But sometimes, yes. Even when I'm tired and grumpy and I just want to sit in my home and rest. Yeah. Last comment.
Getting back to that idea that maybe she changed his mind to
reach out to Gentiles, Mark tells us differently that if you did that already,
yes.
You've never seen demonic.
Yes. Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. So what you're saying is, this can't be Jesus changing his mind to go to Gentiles, because he already did that in chapter 5 with the Gerasene demoniac. So something here, or maybe both stories reinforce that mission to the Gentiles for this community of Gentiles. Maybe they act together as a strong statement in that direction. Again, the irony to me is that Jesus is arguing with the Pharisees and saying, don't tell me what's clean and unclean.
I made it.
Nothing that goes in your body can be unclean. It's what comes out. And then what comes out of him is this derogatory term for the woman. And it's just sort of like, oh, Jesus, you were too tired that day. And so there's a dynamism here that the conversation between one person and another person brings out. And there seems to be a blessing in that, a divine blessing in that conversation. We could go on for weeks, but let's stop here and pray while the big machinery is going by. Yeah, let's have a word of prayer. God, we thank you for the times when we are able to be like the Syrophoenician woman and enter a place where we're not sure if we're welcome, accept the mediocre or coarse reception, and still continue to be in conversation, knowing that you are able to change us when we cross boundaries, and you are able to change others. We thank you that you came in the flesh and took on such deep human connection, and that you would be so humble as to be willing to be wrong in order to give us an example to follow. We give you thanks for all of our thoughts today and for the willingness of people to explore your word in different directions. Thank you for this body and for the communion that you bless us with. Amen.